Welcome to the Money and Time Machine podcast, where you can learn how to rage against the theft of your financial future by listening to a unique perspective on what's holding you back from a life of more money and more time.
Hello and welcome to the Money and Time Machine podcast. I'm your host, Justin Paul. Welcome to episode 51, part two of the Me Myth. I hope you enjoyed part one of the Me Myth last week. Some interesting feedback came to me by way of emails at jp@moneyandtimemachine.com that I received on people's thoughts on the topic. Obviously, I'm very respectful of people's views, what you may have gotten from it. It's not about me. It is, after all about you. So let me continue on. And then in the outro, I'll share my views and thoughts on this double episode. So welcome back to part two of The Me Myth by Andrew Griffiths. As I did last week, I'll surmise the chapter in one or two sentences. I'll extrapolate one or two key points, and then I'll do pose a question to get you pondering. So we start back on chapter 17 called Inspired Communication. In this chapter, Andrew shares his experience of making a profound connection with a group of people with a talk he was slated to do. And the responses varied from being very teary-eyed to, you know, people were feeling full of pride with broad smiles. And the key points in this chapter is being able to listen, and genuinely so, allows you to hear the things that are most important to people. And when you communicate back to them, they feel heard and the connection is profound. The real question is, what are you afraid of when you attempt to connect with people? Are you really that afraid to open up to people? And by opening up, I mean listening with your heart as much as your ears. In chapter 18, he calls this chapter, Chain Yourself to a Tree Once in a While. In this chapter, the author reflects on his university days as part of a community of activists and how passionate they were about their cause. Passionate about their cause was at the heart of their actions. Here, the key points are, nothing can be achieved without at least a modicum of passion. Much more passion, and you're cooking with gas, as the old colloquialism goes. So when you have energy behind you to pursue your goals and dreams, you can bulldoze through life's challenges. The real question is, when was the last time you were lit up about something, anything really? I'm talking about being, instead of being reactive to something, I'm asking you, when was the last time you were excited, truly excited about something? In chapter 19, he calls this, the greatest teacher is Mother Nature. Here, the author shares his experiences living in the tropics, I think it's in Queensland, if memory serves me correctly, and his intimate love affair with nature as a diver, amongst other activities that he partook in. And some of his friends who live in very different areas and lives elsewhere in the world may, you know, they may like the idea of living in nature, but it's not necessarily everyone's idea of the ideal lifestyle. So the key points here is, some people prefer the concrete jungles of city life and suburban life, but it's still important to connect to nature from time to time, to observe and simply be present and in tune. The real question, when was the last time you disconnected from the chaos and hectic pace of modern day living just to do something as simple as walking in a park? You don't need to be near a forest or a beach to enjoy the peace and tranquility of nature. Something local will do just as well. In chapter 20, figure out what you don't want in life. And I love this one. I think it resonates with a lot of people. Here, the author reflects on the conventional wisdom of chasing the things and dreams we were told are important. It's easier to highlight what you don't like, but as negative as that might appear, it's the antidote to know what you really do want. The key points here are, take a hard look at every aspect of your life and note what irks you, what affects you negatively, what affects your mood and feelings for the worse. Now, imagine and toy around with the idea of what could make those things feel, sound, and look better. The real question, what are you afraid of by reflecting on those things in your life, as bad as they may be, that you know could be better, but that only you can decide to do anything about? Chapter 21, Why Worry? Why Worry Indeed? In this chapter, it's clear that worry is part of the human condition. But how many of us give way more power away by engaging in a habit that isn't conducive to a better life? Worry is natural, but not developing an awareness around how you react and respond to worry is really the main crux of the matter here. The key point or points, whilst worry is a natural part of the human condition, learning how to master our response, or responses, I should say, and reactions to worry may prove to be more beneficial than the actual state of worry itself. The real question is whether you can get yourself to change your perception of worrying so that it doesn't cause you to lose power or feel powerless, but instead use worry to your advantage to better understand what the real issue often is, and you know, which is basically, if you think about it, that you're scared, and it's okay to be scared no matter how old you are. Chapter 22, it's time to be honest. Ooh, this was one that felt heavy on my shoulders. In this chapter, the author rather bluntly states that we all lie to ourselves about a myriad of things, some little and others quite daunting, and that we are good at justifying our lack of honesty to ourselves about those things, whatever they might be. The key point here is we have all been guilty of lying and withholding the truth from others, but whatever the justification, and hey, who am I to say it isn't warranted or, you know, or justified, but there seems to be this idea that relief comes from letting go of things we no longer need to defend and protect, and the burden isn't yours to harbor and keep for life. Chapter 23, make a decision and move on. Yeah, the author shares a couple of stories, one of which was personal, but the gist of the chapter that making decisions can be tough. Who amongst us don't know that? In fact, it's easier not to make a decision, but whether you choose to avoid or have to make tough decisions, there are consequences. And he illustrates a process where he uses in the book. So if you want to check the book out, by all means, but we all need to get better at making effective decisions. And yes, even if the outcome isn't necessarily a pleasant one. And the key point, I'll summarize the author's point here with a very popular quote, and most of us have heard it. And it goes like this, beginning of the quote, "In 20 years' time, we will regret far more the things we haven't done than the things we have done," end quote. The real question here is, what is it about making decisions, and I mean life-changing and life-affecting decisions, that you fear, and what will happen to you and those you love if you refuse to accept the responsibility of doing so? Chapter 24, which emotion is driving you? A series of stories in which emotions overrode logic and rationality. It's easy to judge someone else or even yourself, but unless you develop an awareness of how you make or allow your emotions to govern your life, you're always going to be controlled, governed, or victimized by your emotions. The key point, it's a great idea to study your emotions, in fact, to understand the causality and its impacts, both effective and ineffective. By not addressing the cause of your emotions, the triggers, if you will, and how to elicit better responses, you run the risk of repeating the same old patterns. The real question here is, what is stopping you from letting go of the emotions that no longer serve you as they once did, if in fact they ever did? Chapter 25, when did you stop having fun? This one hit home for me for personal reasons, but here the author shares his cheery disposition via a couple of short stories. But one thing is clear, that not taking yourself seriously and having a laugh has many more benefits than taking yourself or life way too seriously. Key points, life can be chaotic and hectic, but nothing breaks the ice quite like a good laugh. A good laugh reminds you and others that life isn't about being miserable. The real question, how often, or in fact, when was the last time you had a really good belly laugh? Chapter 26, don't put the important things off. The author shares an all too familiar story of being too busy to spend time with loved ones, looking successful but hiding all the debt that makes it look possible to look successful. But the reality is most people have very little money to actually show for the image of success. And then you get that call that someone close to you has passed away and you realize how busy you were being busy. The key points, there's nothing wrong with being busy and focused. But when it becomes all-consuming to the detriment of other facets in your life, you have to ask yourself, what delusion are you suffering from? The real question here is whether you're so self-consumed that you forgot those around you or those whom you don't always get to spend time with because of the tyranny of distance. Chapter 27. Put away the self-development books for a while. And boy, oh boy, did I have a big issue with this one. But this one, I've lived for decades and I totally get where the author is going with this. I really like this chapter because it resonated with me. And the idea that you can experience life through books and personal development is a curse where you become the eternal student, the perpetual seeker of knowledge and information. And the author suggests that whilst learning is awesome, and who wouldn't agree, the best learning is done through experiencing life. All too often, people confuse memory recall as being the same as having had the experience. They can regurgitate quotes and memorize chapter and verse. They can recall the information from a seminar, an MP3 they heard, but have little or no experience of the actual information. The next time you say you know something, ask yourself, is it because you've experienced what you say you know, or are you recalling information you came across through reading, through mild or limited experiences, or a series of conversations, or heaven forbid, YouTube? The real question here is, does your information come from a rich experience or a rich memory? Chapter 28, step up and take responsibility for your life. This one tickles a nerve, but I guess there's something in it. Responsibility is a tough lesson to learn, especially when you have to pay the ATO a debt and your life is falling apart around you. This is the author's story. When your name is on the business paperwork, the responsibility is all yours. No escaping the reality. Now, getting through that chapter in his life taught Andrew that you can expect to live a full life only by accepting responsibility. Or I should say, you can't expect to live a full life by only accepting responsibility when it suits you. You know, if you want it all, you have to accept it all. Responsibility is an all or nothing deal. The key point here is there's real power in taking on all the responsibility, or at least more responsibility. Yeah, because you can't be a victim when you take responsibility. You can't accept excuses when you assume responsibility. You can't have responsibility without action. It doesn't work otherwise. The real question here is, do you allow success in other areas of your life to compensate for failure or lack of action in other areas of your life? I think none of us are immune to that little gem. In chapter 29, get back to doing the things you love. In this chapter, the author makes an obvious case that energy begets energy. Doing things you love is a good thing. You owe it to yourself to hang onto some things that bring you joy instead of suppressing the urge to reduce the things you love to nothing but memories of times past. The key point here is find ways to get back to the things that make you happy, or at least made you happy. The emotional environment that you create within yourself helps not just you, but also affects those around you. When you're happy, I think it's fair to say that the chances of that happiness rubbing off on other people is a higher probability. The real question here is whether you carry around the fact that you don't have time for things that once provided you with joy as a measure of your commitment to hard work. It's noble to think, but I think it distracts you from experiencing life fully. Chapter 30, celebrate loud and celebrate long. Look, this is something I've always struggled with. You know, notwithstanding birthdays and, I don't know, weddings and Christmas, that's fine. But it's easy to rejoice in your early achievements, and then you behave as if your continued achievements are nothing more than just the expected norm. So don't forget that when you celebrate your achievements, it's not just you, but those other people, those other hardworking people who helped you that also get to share in the achievement. They also get to celebrate. The key point here is celebrating your success is key to your achievements. Celebrating other people's success is even more important. It's a good habit to get used to. The real question here is, what beliefs do you have around celebrating? Have you been told that celebrating your achievement is akin to boasting, perhaps? Chapter 31, Have a Love Affair with Life. Look, I found this one a bit corny, but I think generally when I find things corny, there's probably something there to be reviewed and looked into a little deeper. Okay. The author conveys that if we expect life and others what we can't seem to do for ourselves, let alone others, that's an interesting paradigm, isn't it? I think we want more from others, the things that we can't seem to do for ourselves. And it sounds paradoxical, but if you get your head around it, it's quite an interesting question to ask of yourself. He calls it a love affair, but others might refer to it as, raising your vibrations, increasing your energy by simply loving more. The question here is, what is it about the idea of loving yourself and loving life that makes you feel uncomfortable? And how could a change in perspective improve your life? Chapter 32, The Battle with Perfection. As a marketing expert, the author appreciates that in certain arenas, like engineering, being right is a critical part of the job. But that aside, trying to be perfect has more to do with being controlling. Being rigid and inflexible can cause more problems than you could imagine. For one, it's exhausting. And while you always try to be the best, and there's nothing wrong with that, it shouldn't come at the expense of feeling that you're never good enough. The question here is whether you use perfection to stop you from experiencing life and from avoiding feedback. That's another one that tickled one of my nerves. The pain of comparison. The author knows well that comparison can be due to seeing yourself in others, or that other people's success creates envy and brings to the surface ill feelings related to perhaps your own misperceptions and insecurities and perceived shortcomings. But either way, comparison has a healthy, but it also has an unhealthy aspect to it. Okay, so key points here. You can use other people's success as a form of inspiration, but also keep in mind the work that other people will have had to do to achieve the desired outcomes. The real question is, before you jump to any conclusions, are you prepared to do what they have done to achieve their success? Chapter 34, The Great Wall of You. This is of particular importance. Here, the author speaks about how, and I'll quote you, sanctimonious and self-righteous, end quote, it is to be dismissive of someone who has hurt your feelings. We live in a world of people, yet, we do our utmost never to be close to people, apart from perhaps maybe, close friends and family. We are more connected, yet more lonely and disconnected than ever. We have protected ourselves so much that we let no one close to us. And what a lonely and shallow way to live. And all because we have become victims of, quote unquote, it's all about me. The key point here, it's better to feel a kaleidoscope of emotions than limit ourselves to the pain of abandonment and feeling hurt all the time. To limit pain is to limit yourself to other possibilities as well. So keep that in mind. The real question here is, can you recall when the last time you opened yourself up to feel more? Chapter 35, and we're nearing the end, just two more chapters to go. In chapter 35, it's time to define the new you. There's something about our culture that makes the idea that you can define yourself as somehow being conceited and self-absorbed. But in fact, you have that power to recreate yourself in your own image instead of playing along to get along. And I mean that in every aspect of your life, from health, relationships, finances, and health. The key points here are, look, and this is something that even I've struggled with, you've got to take the time to think hard about what it is you want your life to look like and be like. You've got to remember, you deserve it and no one else can do it for you. And you must, absolutely must, take the necessary actions to make it come to fruition. Otherwise, all you're doing, ladies and gentlemen, is daydreaming. The real question here is whether you feel worthy enough to do this for yourself. And the last chapter, I knew we'd conclude at some point. It's called Right Here, Right Now. Talk is cheap, isn't it? The author keeps coming back to the same thing, experiencing. You have to take action so that you can start experiencing the life you want. The key point here is you and you alone have to start living your life, because life is lived in the now, not at some future point or stage in life when it's going to be convenient or the timing is right, because there's no such thing, ladies and gentlemen. So simply stated, it's time to start living now. Well, I hope that was useful for you. As I mentioned in last week's episode, the author made this easy for me because the book reads like a menu. It offered me a tasting plate of all sorts of tasty goodies to pick from whenever I was ready to, and to discard whatever didn't look appealing to me. But beware, you know, those things that look unappealing or that I dismiss because of judgment. So why not look into what it is about some of these elements on the plate that triggers you as it did for me? It may well be that the thing you need the most is the thing that you dismissed, and it may taste a lot better than it looks. So stop living vicariously through others, through our children, through our sporting heroes, through other people that we know who are living lives. Stop being a voyeur in life, experiencing it secondhand. At some level, most of us got swept along with these unconscious cultural agreements that none of us were asked our permissions or thoughts on. You know, we were young as we grew up. We were conditioned to run with it without question. We were told it was in our best interest by other people who were well-meaning, but who thought they knew us better than we knew or know ourselves, apparently. And of course, we didn't question anything, but now, you are in a stage in your life where you are questioning your life or certain facets of your life. Now, you are asking of yourself the questions you wished you'd known or you wished you could have asked years past. Perhaps now you're refusing to ignore or pretending not to ignore your unhappiness, your unease or dis-ease. You no longer want to suppress that inner calling, that yearning for something more, a life more aligned with the things you truly value. And it doesn't matter if there's 8.5 billion people and you're the only one that values the things. It doesn't matter. It is what you value. There's an old saying I heard years ago, the opposite of love isn't hate, it's self-absorption. And I remember for some reason it sticks in my brain, and I've been pondering that for years now. And I've read and reread the old classic by Dale Carnegie, Stop Worrying and Start Living. I think it's How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. And I know it's tough, but let's face it, from a social engineering perspective, if we look at religion, and I'm not casting any aspersion if you are religious, please, religion has us believing that we're born sinners, constantly in need of forgiveness. There's a deity in the sky that is constantly judging you. And as I said, I'm not a religious person for the record, and I have no issues with you if you are. That's your journey. If we look at psychotherapy and personal development, has you trying to fix yourself, because there's something wrong, isn't there? If it's not one, there's two, but there always seems to be something wrong. I think that's the narrative that they come at you with, because it's their agenda. So you may get caught up in this trap of being the perpetual student, always seeking but never living. And our capitalist society, and please, just because I'm critiquing our capitalist society doesn't make me a socialist or a communist or anything of the sort. I'm just critiquing here. But our capitalist society encourages you to work the best and prime years and decades of your life. It encourages you to work the best hours of your day, and oftentimes in debt, under the guise of sacrificing yourself so that one day, you can retire, always living in fear that your hard work may not be enough. Because heaven knows, the goalpost keeps getting moved again and again. Then there's politicians. They're always promising that they will make your life better, provided you do the right thing. Funny how the onus is always on you to do the right thing. So I'll conclude, ladies and gentlemen, that from a marketing perspective, can you see now through your own experiences going through these exercises that Andrew Griffith shares through his own experiences that all of us are me-centric? And this is what I meant by I want to give feedback to some of the commentaries that were made. All of us are me-centric. It's part of our being. But when it comes to helping others, and this is the key, we all have an agenda. Yes, you and I have an agenda. The skill is when you want to connect with others that you are able to take your agenda off the table long enough, ladies and gentlemen, until you can discover the real needs of the people or the person you want to help. Then, and only then, will you be able to present your agenda in a way that is authentic and helpful to others in the truest sense. And you can't do that if what you're doing is all about you. I'm Justin Paul, host of the Money and Time Machine podcast. Until next we speak, bye from me.
Thanks for listening to the Money and Time Machine podcast. And remember, you're either someone else's version of a money and time machine, or you can learn how to become your very own effective money and time machine and to live with purpose on purpose.